I think that we should allow our magnificent, glorious dinosaurs to be taken out by the volcano.
A dire warning indeed from Dr. Ian
Malcolm. Residents are on alert this holiday weekend after three sightings. Oh,
I
wait,
to say that a pseudoceratops
had a... ...cargo hold that, for the moment anyway, contains the animal itself, presumably with the infant alongside.
Investigating what the family claimed to be a near-death experience.
They're taking no chances of a repeat of the San Diego incident.
Ruined a national park where the U.S. Department of Wildlife continues to investigate the aftermath of a Deciniceratops and Alice.
This now predicts an extinction level event will kill off the last living dinosaurs on the planet.
I'm talking about man-made cataclysmic.
Welcome to the Dino Watch podcast, a show helping you to separate the facts from the fiction as we look at incident reports from the world and break down where dinosaurs have been sighted in the wild. I'm your host for this show, Tom Jurassic, and those of you familiar with this show will be conscious that this is a bold new direction for our platform. For years, I've worked alongside Brad Jost and others to cover Jurassic World, the unique visitors attraction which used to function on Isla Nublar. Since its closure, we've explored some of the conspiracy theories around international genetics and their work. We know how crazy that human hybrids rumour was in retrospect. Don't worry, none of that on this show, I promise. And we have also looked at the wider impact in the world. All of that changed, however, when dinosaurs escaped from Lockwood Manor Estate in California in 2018. Now, without Brad knowing, I've decided to use our platform to explore the real problem which we are all facing. I've set up a secondary feed on the podcast channel to hide this from here, so you use this feed to get in touch with me and Brad will be none the wiser, and we can use it to make sure that we're having these important conversations. We know the dinosaurs are dangerous and the dinosaurs can be deadly, but the Department for Fish and Wildlife aren't always honest about what's going on out there. So in this show, we aim to separate fact from fiction and bring you the real news on the dinosaurs. For today's inaugural episode, we are delighted to be able to talk to Cal Noble, who lives in Northern California, not far from the former Lockwood Manor site. It made sense for us to reminisce for our initial episode, so today we are going to talk about the 2018 incident. Cal, thanks for joining me. Why don't you introduce yourself to the audience and tell us a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
Hi there. My name is Cal Noble. I live in an area of Northern California that is what we would call unincorporated, meaning that it's not really part of a city or a town. Yeah. But where I live is in a, you know, a humble home in the mountains, and currently just with, you know, the weird state of the world and everything going on, a lot of what I do for a living is online. I help people with marketing and business functions that are mostly online now because of the weird state of the world. And so I spend a lot of time in my cabin. It's really fairly self-sufficient. And so I also spend a lot of time doing things in service of that, whether it's gathering supplies or making sure that my power supply is in good shape and maintenance of the property that I live on and the place that I live. So that's who I am and what I spend a lot of my time doing. So
Cool. Thank you for that context. I think our listeners will really appreciate that. So am I correct in saying that you've lived where you are currently, which is fairly close to Lockwood Manor, for quite some time at this point? Is that right?
Yes, I have lived close to the Lockwood Manor site since around 2014.
Okay.
And it's you know, I'm saying the things that I'm saying just because I want folks who are listening to really feel like I am a normal human being like them. I wasn't expecting any of the things that were to come with living where I live or doing what I do.
So you've alluded quite nicely there to obviously the specific incident that's happened, and then the consequences of that incident, which are really having an impact on all of us currently. And I do want to go into that a little bit more. Obviously, I'm conscious that that may be quite traumatic, so we'll come on to that a little bit later. But initially, I really wanted to talk more about the manor itself. So obviously, you've been there for a while, and we've all heard lots of crazy conspiracy theories. There's loads of different stories on the internet. You just have to go and look through forums, look on social media, and you can see lots of stories about Benjamin Lockwood cloning humans, having dinosaurs in a basement. It all seems quite extreme. So I guess initially I was interested as to whether there were any stories about the manor that you've heard in the time you've lived there. Are there any rumours that sort of corroborate the things that we're seeing online, or just any other stories locally that you've heard about the area?
I can't necessarily pinpoint where or, you know, when the things that I can speak to started. When I, you know, every once in a while I do have to go into the town in Northern California that is closest to me, either, you know, to pick up supplies or do things like that. And I, you know, I feel a little more comfortable not naming that town just to keep a little bit of privacy. But you know, and when I would go into that town, and in stores or, you know, in the downtown area, you know, when I would run into people that I am acquainted with, there were always just sort of little stories in passing, like, you know, and stories that I could relate to because, and like I said, I don't remember exactly when it started, but there were definitely the first thing that I remember noticing was odd noises sort of that were echoing through the wilderness and through the trees where I lived. And I was not even aware that it was coming from Lockwood at first, but figured that out later. But it was, at first, it was odd, what I would call odd machinery noises at odd times. And it was, you know, early morning around dusk, but it was also very late at night after midnight. And sounds of machinery working, but also, you know, machinery being unloaded is maybe what I would call it. But then, you know, as time passed after that, it was what I would call strange animal noises that at the time I wasn't sure what they were. And now obviously I can make a connection to what they probably were. And living in the forest, sometimes you kind of write those things off. As you know, it's just an animal, or it's just someone doing something that's probably fine. But they became more frequent, and they became maybe a little more concerning because, you know, especially the animal noises, because if it reached a point where, you know, before the 2018 incident, where I really wasn't sure how to identify any of these noises, and they sounded monstrous at times.
Yeah.
And so that was unsettling for sure.
Sounds terrifying.
And like I said, when I would go into town and see people who I was acquainted with, it was sort of a thing in passing where it was like, have you been hearing this too? And it was like, yeah, it's really weird, and
yeah,
we're just being careful, sort of a conversation. But that's sort of what how the rumors went, because it was really strange and monstrous noises that no one was really sure what to think of or what to do about, because like, I mean, part of it at first was like, if I tell someone, like, are they gonna think I'm nuts?
Yeah, I get
so that's kind of what that was like. But
thank you for sharing that, and it paints a really interesting picture, because obviously the events that have happened have since gone on to really have an impact on the whole country and in many ways the whole world. But actually it's clear that for a lot of months there has been a lot of built up trauma endured by the towns local to that estate, that really has led to obviously this incident happening and then the impact that that's had afterwards. So I really do appreciate you sharing insight into that, and obviously I absolutely appreciate as well that living in the woods as you do, you're probably naturally more conscious about the encounters that you might have with wild animals. So having all
Definitely,
of these experiences
yeah.
can only exasperate that even further still. I did just want to ask, purely out of curiosity more so than anything, so obviously you said you had friends in the local town who you would see now and then. Did you ever actually bump into Benjamin Lockwood, the man who owned the estate, or was he somebody who anyone who you knew ever really had a connection with, and did they ever tell you what he was like as a person?
I know people who knew him.
Yeah.
I didn't ever meet him personally. And it was really that sort of environment where, like, you know, the sort of small town environment where you know
everyone knows everybody, kind of.
Sure, and with someone like Benjamin Lockwood, you know and you hear a lot of things.
Yeah.
I remember always hearing that he was a very eccentric person.
Okay.
And sort of, you know, there was a lot of, at least from my perspective, there was a lot of mystery surrounding that name. Because he was a name that was said a lot, and then, you know, there are pictures of him on the news and in town in places and things like that. And so, you know, people knew of him and knew about him, but I mean me personally, I don't know that I ever had a full grasp on him as a person, just because I didn't ever meet him. But yeah,
okay, no, that makes a lot of sense. And there's a lot of just rumors around him as a person and the character and the kind of things he's been connected to, even some potential connections to Jurassic World. So it's interesting to hear that he was quite a sheltered figure, I suppose, because really, you know, even the reporters who I imagine are digging through all of these stories currently haven't got to the base of those things. And there's definitely lots of conjecture out there about who he was and what he was involved in.
Definitely.
So obviously the main thing that really brought us together this evening, and the reason why I approached you and you were gracious enough to join us on this show, is the incident that happened in 2018 that really changed everything. So I wanted to ask, what were things like as sort of it approached that fateful night? So obviously you said there was already activity in the town beforehand, but as it approached that date, were you conscious of an escalation in activity? Was there more traffic locally? Anything like that, really, you can pinpoint as leading up to that event?
The noises I spoke about earlier,
yeah,
weren't constant. But I want to say in the week or two before the incident, things really be the noises, both machinery and animal, became frequent. They were an every night occurrence. And so that, I mean, if nothing else, that definitely signaled to me that like something significant or important was happening there.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that's probably true for anyone you would ask, is that the noise just became kind of constant. And
yeah,
it didn't feel like a build. It felt, you know, consistent over a week or two, and then sort of one big crescendo of noise on that night of the incident.
I was just actually, as you were saying that, I was going to use the word crescendo. I think one of our former contributors on our podcast would really appreciate that. It's interesting to hear about that. And obviously for you, I guess it got to the point where this noise was so frequent that actually if it was building up to anything, it would be really hard to notice that outside of everything that was already going on there. So that makes a lot of sense. I guess now we need to come to that fateful night, really. So at this point, we've all seen the news reports. We know what happened. We know how the emergency services responded afterwards, and obviously the subsequent cleanup effort from the US Fish and Wildlife Service. But I wanted to ask, were there any stories of people living in the area on the night, hearing anything or witnessing anything? You know, we've seen reports of all different kinds of dinosaurs escaping. And I can imagine that there were a lot of encounters that would have happened around where you live, around the towns where your friends live. So have you heard any details about any of those encounters?
So two sort of things really stick out to me. And the first thing is that, the first thing I'll say is that on that night, when everything was happening and there were noises all over the place, my sort of instinct was to stay close to my house and where I live, just to remain safe. But what I did hear from friends and otherwise were plenty of stories of either near car accidents or and a couple of actual, you know, accidents, because people were driving through the mountains and either had to dodge strange animals that they didn't know what they were, or in the process of dodging those animals, they had a car accident. And so that's what I heard the most of. And for me personally, like, what I remember about that night is lots of shaking of the ground. Partly like, you know, living in parts of California, you're kind of used to the occasional ground shake from tectonic activity and small earthquakes and
tremors,
so,
and those kinds of things, I can imagine.
Definitely, yeah. But these were a lot closer together and a lot more than normal.
So did you at that point, did you have any idea what was going on, or were you fearful that it was an earthquake essentially happening?
At the time I didn't know, but when I realized that it was something different was sort of on that night. I also, you know, when I was, you know, outside but close to my house, you know, I would hear things in the bushes or hear things far off in the distance rustling in the trees, but I never saw anything. But when I knew that it was something different was the next morning, waking up to check outside, and there were multiple areas where massive trees were completely out of the ground and, you know, laying down, creating at least two or three clearings.
That's near, crazy.
Near my house. And yeah. I was, you know, my thought was, okay, this is either like one of my thoughts was like, okay, this is construction equipment or something for some, but there was no reason for that.
Trying to find that rational answer at that point, isn't it?
Sure. Yeah. But there was no reason for there to be like construction machinery there. And so that's when I kind of realized that this was some sort of connection to the animal noises I had been hearing and that this was something big.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's definitely one way to put it. And yeah, I can imagine just waking up to that, seeing sort of the devastation afterwards, but not experiencing it directly would have been very confusing. I did want to ask you about one fairly well-documented incident. So we were able to get a hold of some Fish and Wildlife Service reports, and it looks like they outline an incident with a stegomoloch at a local gas station that appeared to actually happen slightly before the incident itself, which is very interesting to say the least. I definitely am curious about the specifics of that. And I was just interested as to whether you'd heard any more about that incident. From what we've heard and what we've seen on message boards, it seems like a lot of it was hushed. But I wondered if anyone had mentioned anything about that to you and how the DFW both responded to that, but also the other incidents as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was fairly hush-hush. There were whisperings about it. And before this sort of report and rumor came about, I wasn't even familiar with what a stegomoloch was.
Okay.
And so after learning what that was, I certainly had the thought of, okay, maybe this was something that I heard near my house and perhaps had something to do with the damage in the forest for sure. So,
yeah. That would make a lot of sense. It's interesting, isn't it? I think just more broadly, the fact that dinosaurs are in the world now is something that's so hard to comprehend. And I can imagine as somebody who really was at the forefront of our first encounters with them in the world, you must have thought that things like that were a hoax initially and it was just some elaborate prank that had got out of hand. I can't imagine attempting to get my head around thinking that dinosaurs may have actually been in my backyard. That must be crazy.
It was certainly hard to grasp at first.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But after, I mean, as time went on, seeing documented accounts and videos online and all of that stuff, it was like this. I mean, it made it real, but it also made it like, okay, this has sort of spread even further from where I am.
Yeah.
So
it's interesting you touch on that as well. We will, throughout the duration of this podcast, be interviewing a lot of people. A lot of them, it has to be said, are focused around California, the Sierra Nevada, all of those kinds of places where these initial encounters have really happened. Mm-hmm. But you're certainly right to say that they are slowly spreading and expanding, which is both worrying, and in some ways, I don't know, I'm optimistic that we might find a way to coexist eventually. I did want to ask specifically around the topic of encounters, if you've actually seen any animals since the Lockwood Manor incident, and what is the general consensus locally now those animals are out there? Are people scared to go out? Because obviously you live in an area of natural beauty, there's lots of hiking trails, lots of places that people would usually come and enjoy on holiday. Has all of that seen a massive difference?
I think as far as like the attitude locally, I mean me personally, as someone who lives where I live, you know, which is certainly distanced from urban areas, you know, my attitude towards it was sort of I want to learn how to, you know, be I want to learn how to survive this, but also be safe and be as careful as possible. And I think a lot of the people that I know are, you know, fully on the side of caution and being as absolutely strictly safe as possible. Because a lot of the folks I am connected with, which isn't that many, granted, just because of where I live, and the town I go into is small, but in the small town I live in, a lot of those folks are, you know, not too old, and they have children, and so their focus is really, you know, being as safe as possible, and but still doing everything we need to do, and being educated about the situation and educating their kids about the situation. But I think the word that keeps coming to mind is, you know, being careful and being safe. For them, me personally, I've actually taken this as an opportunity to dive into the paleontological world, and learn as much as I can about the eras of time that these creatures that are apparently out in our world now come from. And so that obviously includes learning about carnivores and herbivores and the different ways they behave, but also, you know, there are not just dinosaurs out there. There are, from what I've heard, there are some creatures from other eras of time. Both from, and my paleontological knowledge is always expanding, but you know, from what I understand, a lot of these creatures come from the Cretaceous and Jurassic eras, but there are also rumors of sightings of creatures from the Permian period and the Triassic period and other other animals that would not technically be called dinosaurs. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of genetic power being wielded at the moment. So my dive into that knowledge has sort of informed the way I go outside and go on hikes and things like that. And so whenever I have seen things, it is from a distance, and that always, whenever I do see something, it always sort of signals and informs my next actions. And so I always want to keep my distance from those things and give them their space, just like I want my space. And, you know, if the things I have seen, I will say haven't been the big ones. Again, my paleontological knowledge is limited, but I do think I have seen velociraptors from a distance.
Okay.
And I also want to say that I have seen a triceratops from a distance.
Okay.
The velociraptors I have seen scattered quickly. Yeah. They were fast. and the triceratops that I believe I saw was sort of, I mean, I don't know if it was trying to hide in foliage.
Yeah.
But the part of it that I saw was the top of its crest of its head sort of protruding from some foliage. And so
it's interesting you say velociraptors, because the InGen list that leaked from Isla Nublar after its fall show that there's only one velociraptor left, or at least supposedly one velociraptor left. So that's quite interesting. And I was just going to add to that as well. Those same lists. So this is something that perhaps I shouldn't say on air, but a lot of the internal documentation from that island has popped up online since obviously the tragic Jurassic World incident in 2015. And since then, a lot of the information that we've seen suggests that the animals on the island, even the ones that weren't put out into enclosures, were mainly from the Jurassic and Cretaceous periods, as you say. And there's not really anything from the Permian era on their lists. So it's definitely interesting to think about what might be out there, and what maybe people are seeing but aren't recognizing, or equally if there is more out there that we don't understand. I mean, at this point, nobody really knows for certain, right? And while these things are still going through Senate, and they're still being refined internally, there's no real way of knowing and tracking just how much is out there. And I guess in some ways that's a little terrifying, really, isn't it?
I have to say that it is a little nerve-wracking to think about that, especially if there are animals out there that weren't documented.
Yeah.
And that makes me wonder who else is responsible for the other animals that are out in the world at the moment. Excuse me. But also, I have to say, just because I have taken a dive into paleontology, while it is nerve-wracking, it is also, you know, mildly interesting to see to see these things out in the wild and be able to sort of see something that hasn't existed for millions and millions of years. And so it's an interesting thing. So
I think interesting is definitely the word of the hour for sure. So I did want to ask, and this is something that, again, alongside those rumors of other animals, has been popping up online quite frequently. And there seems to be a consensus, backed up by sprinkled reports from various outlets, that these animals may appear to slowly be migrating. So I was interested in that regard. Have you actually seen less activity in recent months? Those encounters you described earlier, how close were they to that initial incident? And has that kind of waned off recently?
You know, maybe I hadn't truly realized it, but, or maybe I had just gotten used to it. But I mean, the encounters I described weren't too long after the incident. They were maybe within a year or two, but I would say that they certainly haven't happened as frequently in the last 2 years, at least. I haven't really known what to chalk that up to, other than, you know, animals migrate, animals move.
Okay, well, I guess to really round this out, Cal, and this is going to be quite a subjective question, so please, by all means, do feel free to take your time with this. Okay. What do you think that we need to do to fix things? And how do we deal with dinosaurs? That's the million-dollar question at the moment.
Okay. So, my thoughts on that are, honestly, being someone who lives the way that I do and has done so for a while, and what I mean by that is, you know, living in the mountains and the wilderness, sort of off the grid in a lot of ways, my inkling and my instinct is a good thing to do is to adapt and make changes in human lifestyle. And I lean that way because of the way that I have lived for a while, but also because I'm growing to understand these creatures and how awesome and also scary they can be. Both predator and, you know, both carnivore and herbivore are both creatures that haven't been here in a very long time, and I think they are just as perplexed in a lot of ways as far as how to adapt and what to do as we are as human beings. And
that's a really good point.
And so I think I'm someone who doesn't think it's right to try to capture or exterminate or population manage any of these things. I just don't know that any of that is the right thing to do, nor do I think it is possible. I think the best course of action is to try to adapt and try to coexist, and I don't even fully know if that's possible, but I think it's something we have to try. So that falls on a lot of, you know, everyday people like me. The government agencies can try and do what they want to do, but in the end I don't think control is possible.
Yeah.
So I think adaptation is the best course of action. So.
Okay, well, that is where we'll leave this. Thank you so much for your time, Cal. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us for the show.
Sure, I really appreciate you having me on and letting me talk a little bit. So.
Hopefully you've enjoyed gaining some more insight into the initial incident which started this crazy period of time we're living through. In future episodes of the Dino Watch podcast, we will aim to explore other encounters which people have had in the wild so we can paint a broader picture of the incidents which the US Fish and Wildlife Service are not telling you about. Stay tuned for our next episode, where we'll talk to a farm owner whose family have been plagued by Compsognathus, causing havoc with their livestock and leading to their daughter being admitted to hospital. If you enjoy this show, make sure to subscribe wherever you listen. Together, we can learn how to survive with dinosaurs in the wild.